This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is February 16th, 2009. This is the third session with Ted Crabb, Emeritus Director of the Wisconsin Union. Ted, we wanted to pick it up today with your reminiscences about the days of turmoil on campus related to the Vietnam War and the impact on the Union.
From a personal standpoint, I became director on July 1, 1968, and so I was not on campus in the fall of 67 at the time of the Dow riots. I can remember reading about them, but was not on campus to observe what happened and how it happened and the aftermath. A number of my friends were intimately involved with the situation, but I wasn't. My first visit to the campus came in, I believe it was February of 1968, when I came over to Madison for interviews for the job. And I can't remember exactly, but I think I was approved by, recommended by Chancellor Sewell and approved by the Regents in probably March of 1968. I did come to the campus to attend the memorial service for Martin Luther King, and had started meetings at that time and getting information from people on the campus about how what was happening on campus and what we could expect. I think it would be fair to say that I had no idea of what the future held in terms of the kinds of protests that would continue in 1968, 69, and 70, and how the Union would be involved in so much of that. But when I started in July of 68, that was all ahead of me, and it came fairly quickly that fall with, as I mentioned earlier, the Peter Pan incident, and then an incident involving a racial issue in the Roskiller, and the real turning point came in January of 1969, when the Union sponsored a program called the Black Revolution. I think that was the exact title of it, which was intent was to provide a setting where how far have blacks progressed, both on campus and in the community and in the state and the nation. There were a number of just major speakers here for that event, and the, in a sense, I think it's fair to say the outgrowth of the event was that the black students, this was certainly not intended, but the black students organized themselves and petitioned the university to have a black student center on the campus. The outcome of that was that that did in fact happen, that the chancellor eventually proposed such a black student center over on Johnson Street in a home that was owned by the university. It was the first time that there'd been any kind of a recognition for an ethnic group with a separate campus organization.
So this program was a Union program.
It was a Union-sponsored program.
And you had approved
and,
it.
And, yeah, well, our board had approved it. Uh-huh. It was sponsored by the Union Directorate. And it was a major undertaking, and it was a spectacular program. All of the big names, and almost all of the big names in the nationally for blacks were here for that. Jesse Jackson, just as one example of a person who was here, just a very, very effective program. Mm-hmm. And it really did, in fact, raise the consciousness level of the campus community. Mm-hmm. It was a week or 10-day long program, mm-hmm. and it really did raise the consciousness level.
Where was it held?
Primarily in Great Hall or the theater, mm-hmm. But there were discussion groups along with it, so that it was an ongoing kind of a program. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very effective. And then
does this predate the presence of Afro-American studies on campus?
I think so, yes. I think that was another outgrowth of the established one. That was one of the black demands and was an outgrowth of that followed along with the establishment of the Afro-American Center over on Johnson Street. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that
students the program mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you're on.
This certainly had a major impact for the campus and also for the union because it really raised the awareness level within the union, within students that are on union programs and staff. And it was a very valuable program, but it was one that, as I said, precipitated this black student demand for more recognition on the campus that resulted, in fact, in the universities recognizing that.
Were your relations with the black student leaders at that time cordial or tense or?
Well, I can't remember specifically. I can only say that my suspicion would be that because we sponsored that program, there was a lot of communication with the black students. Mm-hmm. And they were very responsive to the fact that we were willing to go, to reach out and develop this kind of a program involving this many major significant campus or national leaders. And so mm-hmm. I don't remember the specifics, but I'm pretty sure that I'm pretty confident I can say that we had good relations at that point with the black community because mm-hmm. we sponsored the program and we put up the money to make this happen. Mm-hmm. Also in this year, Chancellor Sewell resigned and the regents eventually brought in Chancellor Young to take his place. And I think Ed started in the fall of 1969, as I recall.
And Professor Sewell resigned in the summer, did he?
I think so, yes.
After the spring riots?
The following summer.
Oh.
He was here for a full year after the riots and more.
Sewell was?
Sewell was, yeah. And Sewell was the one that hired me. Mm-hmm. And but then he resigned, and the regents appointed Ed Young as the new chancellor. I've been trying to remember, and I'm not clear enough to really recall the specifics, that there were protests in the spring of 1969, but until I go back and refresh my memory as to what those were, I'm not sure. The protests continued throughout the year, in the fall of 69 and on into 70, culminating, of course, in the shootings at Kent State and the riots on campus, which brought out the National Guard, which led to the closing of classes before the end of the semester and shutting down the campus as far as students were concerned. Throughout this two-year period, in 68, 69, whenever protests were organized on the campus, the union was union facilities were used by the protesters to organize activities for the particular event or events that were scheduled or were going to happen. During this period, the protesting groups would meet regularly at the union. They would plan their events, their activities. When they had scheduled events, they were typically planned around the noon hour so that the television cameras could be there to record the events, then have time to go back to their stations and develop the film and have them ready for the 6 o'clock news. Mm-hmm. Once the television filming was done at around the noon hour, the event would essentially collapse because the whole purpose was to get television coverage and to increase people's awareness of what was happening in their view, what was happening in Vietnam. The union, we had a responsibility during that period, clearly, to provide meeting space to student organizations and to not discriminate on whether you agreed or disagreed with a particular student organization. Mm-hmm. And if the students that were protesting, they were recognized as a student organization, if they wanted to meet to talk about protest activities, then we weren't in a position where we could decide whether, well, that's a good meeting or that's a bad meeting. And so their meetings were held here at the building. Some of them used to be held up in Great Hall. In the spring, they would be held on the terrace, and depending on the weather conditions. At the same time, they were always monitored so that there were informants in the rooms who knew what the plans were going to be. And
when you say monitored, by whom? By the federal government? Or?
I'm sure by the federal government, by the local police department, by the campus police, just generally. They were involved in sitting in on some of the meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And the union in that period suffered a lot. We took great criticism from the community because of being involved in providing meeting space for these organizations. That affected our regular routine business. For example, during the protest years, the faculty stopped coming to the union for lunch. This used to be a major gathering point. The union used to be a major gathering point for faculty at lunchtime. And it was just a wonderful thing to see the interaction of students and faculty around the dinner table. Once the protest started, the faculty stopped coming because they weren't willing to have to cross the picket lines or the lines of shouts at them trying to get attention. And so they just stopped coming to the union. And that we really lost a great deal over that part of it. It also hurt us in terms of our non-student general daily business in terms of food services and in terms of general building use, where people in the community who are members of the union decided not to come to the union because, of having to cross the protest lines and in objection to what was happening here on the campus. The union was our role developed in all of this as sort of a safe place.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't by any design that this happened. We didn't have a meeting with the campus leaders or the police department or anyone that said, well, let's make the union a safe place. This just happened by in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it was respected on all sides with all of the activity that went on during this period of window breaking and of canister throwing, tear gas canister throwing and everything. We only on two occasions that I can recall were windows ever broken in the union. And one of them was a misplaced tear gas canister that wasn't intended to be tossed where it was, and it went through a window in the Park Street entrance. And the other time was a window that was inadvertently broken in the cafeteria.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't any organized activity that broke the windows, but we were respected as a safe place. And the police would chase students down the hill, and once they came to the union, it would stop.
The police did not enter.
They did not enter the building. I don't ever remember them entering the building in terms of an official force coming in. And as I say, this wasn't by any organized design. It was just accepted that there needed to be a place on campus that was safe, and the union fulfilled that role.
Ted, how were you feeling at this point, say during the year 1969? Were you frustrated, exhilarated, angry, unhappy?
Yes. I was, in a sense, all of those adjectives would be appropriate. I was frustrated. I was angry. I'd get frustrated at the back and forth between students or protesters and the police department. On the other hand, I would marvel at the way university police officers in particular would handle particular situations.
Mm-hmm.
In which they would show great wisdom and good judgment. And it was trying to avoid incidents without having to get involved in arresting people.
Mm-hmm.
The campus police did a superb job. The City of Madison police were more problematic. The leadership of the police department was not in favor of all of this activity, and they were more interested in arresting people and stopping it, and they didn't always use, in my view, they didn't always use good judgment in the way they approached the issues. And they would they would do things that would just provide a real focus for students to engage more students in the activity. Mm-hmm. You know, the students knew that people in general didn't like long hair, and so they grew their hair long, and they did it knowingly. Mm-hmm. They knew that they objected to the clothes that they were wearing, and so they wore more of the same. And mm-hmm. they knew that they didn't like the this or the that, and so they would do more of the same, because they knew that that would get a reaction from the police department or from the newspapers, and put pictures in the paper, and so that would only encourage them, and they would show this as, how stupid can you be when you mm-hmm. do these kinds of things. Another problem we had during this period was drug activity. There was a lot of marijuana being smoked, no question. The Madison Police Department was particularly anxious to use the union to picture the union as a major drug center. And I can remember one headline at the time was that the union, Roskeller, was the drug capital of the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And you know, we would just shake our heads when we'd see something like this. There was a concern, oh, the union is supplying drugs, as though this was an organized activity at the union. The union's supplying drug to the high schools, and it's reaching the kids in the high schools. And mm-hmm. and you've got to keep the high school students out of the union. And one activity we did was we prepared letters that went to the high schools, urging them to point out to all of the students that the union is a membership organization. It's for students of the university and faculty and alumni, and it's not for high school students, and they're not welcome unless they are here for a specific invited occasion. Mm-hmm. And letters were sent out to the schools to distribute to the classrooms. Mm-hmm. The control of the regents from a political standpoint had changed, so that it was now there was a Republican as president of the regents, and there was a strong Republican group on the regents, and they were also interested in this drug issue. I can remember one regent making a statement to the newspaper that we should have guards at each entrance to the building and check IDs when people enter to make sure that only eligible people can be in the building. We should paint the Roskeller white with lace curtains on the windows to clean up that mess in the union. Mm-hmm. And it just, again, this just, it encouraged those who were smoking to smoke more, mm-hmm. just in defiance, because this was a period of defiance.
Ted, were you politically sympathetic to one side or the other, or did you force yourself to be politically neutral?
I have to answer that in two ways. Personally, I was sympathetic to the protesters in terms of our role in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Professionally, on the job, I had to be as neutral as I could possibly be. Mm-hmm. And so there was always this struggle personally between personal feelings from job responsibility of mm-hmm. of being open to both sides and mm-hmm. reaching out to both sides and not prejudging where positions were coming from.
Ted, did you fear for the future of the union at this time?
Well, yes and no. I am basically an optimistic person, mm-hmm. and I figured eventually we'd work our way through this. Mm-hmm. I was fearful that whether we would ever regain the stature that we'd had at one time, mm-hmm. in serving the role that we played in terms of serving students, faculty and staff, and alumni, mm-hmm. and that it would be hard to rebuild that confidence. And but on the other hand, as I say, I'm basically optimistic, and so I felt that, yeah, we'll eventually come out of this, but it's going to be a tough time to get there. And the course, the interesting twist in the end on all this was the Sterling Hall bombing, which happened in September of 1970. And it was
August,
almost...
wasn't it?
Pardon?
August of
1970. Or August, yeah, late August, yeah. That's right, late August. And it was just as though somebody pulled a curtain down or a shade down, mm-hmm. and the campus shut down. And students stopped, protest ended immediately. Students didn't want to live close to the campus. They wanted to get away from the campus. They stopped attending events and activities. They would come to class and they would leave right away. And it was just, you know, as I say, it was like somebody pulled the curtain and everything stopped except going to class.
Do you remember the bombing? Were you in town?
Oh, yeah, very vividly. In fact, one funny story. We were asleep at the time, and I heard this noise, and my wife rolled over. And what was that? And I said, oh, it was just a bomb going off, and go back to sleep. And we didn't realize what it was until the next morning, and we woke up. And at that time, I walked up the hill to the area of Sterling Hall. And as I came past the south side of Bascom Hall, Chancellor Young was just walking up from Sterling Hall, and I've never seen a person look as drained of everything as he did at that particular moment. I think he probably had just been down and had just seen the destruction that had taken place, and it just, the color was gone, his personality was gone. It was just, he was just absolutely a stunned individual, and that's when it really hit me that, boy, this is serious. The next night, or no, two or three nights later, we were asleep and the phone rang, and it was the university police saying that they had just received a call from the police department in Milwaukee, that they'd received a call that there was a bomb set in the Union that was to go off in 30 minutes. And you know, all I could do was say, well, that's about now, isn't it? You know, what can you do at that point when you hear that it's going to go off in less than 30 minutes? Because if the call was placed to Milwaukee and they called the Madison Police Department or the campus police, and then the campus police called me, well, it was probably down to 15 or 20 minutes by that point. And what can you do to respond? And so you say, thank you very much, and I'll be right there, but what can you do? Mm-hmm. And it turned out that nothing happened. It was just a crank call. There was a call. Apparently such a call had been placed, but fortunately, nothing came of it. But it was, people were just, they're really riding on the edge at that point, because this was so dramatic.
Ted, do I remember correctly that when the National Guard was on campus and students were being tear gassed, or rioters mm-hmm. were being mm-hmm. tear gassed, that students would come into the Union for relief?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Aid stations for?
Yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But much of the tear gassing was taking place over in the Library Mall, a significant part of it. And so, again, this was the Union in that position of being a safe haven, where it was a place to retreat, if you will, mm-hmm. To get away from it and to catch your breath, and if you were injured, to get aid. But absolutely, that many of the pictures of students at the time who would be running away from the tear gas and just flowing into the Union.
Were the services provided by the Union itself by the students?
By student groups. Yep. There was one night. This is going back to going back to May of 1970. There was one night during that period where things got particularly tough on the campus, and I and the staff were really thinking, you know, this is the point where I think we better close the Union to protect the building, and I just am really nervous about what's going on. And the student president and several of the other officers who were there, and we talked about it, and he said, you can't do that. You can't do that. You can't shut down this building at this time. It's got to be here. Mm-hmm. And eventually, I concurred with what they were saying and realized that, you know, we couldn't shut it down, that we had to keep it open. Mm-hmm. And that was as close as I came to shutting down the building and during the period. Mm-hmm. There were one of the other events that happened here that just, you know, everybody was so on edge, and you were looking for people to blame, mm-hmm. whether or not it was a legitimate blame. That wasn't the issue. There was this incident up at UW Oshkosh where a number of black students were arrested, and the repercussions on this campus were that the vice chancellor, Chan Young, said something to the effect that when the question was raised whether students from Oshkosh would be allowed to transfer to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, he said, well, we won't prejudge them. We'll take each case by itself. Well, that just, everybody from at the higher up levels, the regents and the legislature just jumped all over him for that. And it was, he just was in real trouble in terms of explaining what made all the sense in the world. You can't prejudge people mm-hmm. by their actions. You have to consider each case in and of itself and review it individually. And that was a very difficult moment for Chan. Another time happened in one of the events in Great Hall in which I think it was Stokely Carmichael who was speaking, although I'm not positive. I believe it was Stokely Carmichael. And several of his attendants had guns. Mm-hmm. And the question was raised, well, why didn't you, if guns aren't allowed in university buildings, why didn't you stop them? Well, that's a great question to raise when you're not in the situation. Mm-hmm. When you're in a room with 400 to 500 people, to go up to the front of the room and say, now, you'll have to leave and take your guns with you because guns aren't allowed in university buildings. You can just almost predict what the response is going to be. Mm-hmm. And yet the criticism afterwards of what those who were in the room, university people in the room, took for not ordering that be stopped. It was just so unreasonable. And in the same way, I remember coming back again to this whole issue of drugs in the building, in which hearings up at the regent level and at the legislature on the extent of drugs and what were we doing to control this. The emotions just carried the day with that, and the people who were struggling with how they should respond to the issue of drugs in communities were looking for answers of, well, let's just ban them. And, mm-hmm. you know, that wasn't possible. Mm-hmm. And people lost sight of reason during that period. It's just incredible. Some of the, recently I happened to come upon a transcription of a legislative hearing on the issue of drugs. Mm-hmm. And I read through it and I thought, oh my goodness, this happened? Mm-hmm. It was like just a tale off of a novel that somebody was describing this. And I just couldn't believe that these kinds of questions and these kinds of accusations and this kind of expectation of how we could solve the drug problem with a wave of a magic wand was happening. It was a very difficult time.
Ted, during this time period, are the cafeterias operating? Mm-hmm. Is the ice cream shop mm-hmm. operating?
We didn't have an ice cream shop at the time. But,
oh, you didn't?
No, but the cafeteria was operating.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yes. And during the spring and good weather, the students would meet, assemble at 9 o'clock out on the terrace mm-hmm. To plan the day's events. Mm-hmm. And yeah, all the food units operated. We continued a pattern of trying to operate the building just as normal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for the most part, we did that. Our revenues were down, obviously, mm-hmm. and our attendance was down. Mm-hmm. But we tried to maintain throughout this period, made every effort possible to operate and have the facilities available as they would have been in a normal operating day.
Ted, I know we're going to get to the Union Theater in a separate session, but the concert series that the theater ran and still runs, I believe, mm-hmm. every season. Was that affected attendance-wise?
I don't recall. In late May, in May, when these the major disruption events happened, the concert series would have been over by then, so that it wouldn't have been a factor. But in terms of buying tickets to the concert series, our overall ticket sales dipped during that period because of people not wanting to come to the campus because of the activity on the campus. One other example of an interesting one that I got involved with was, as you know, or you may know, the so-called case of Soglin versus Kaufman. And this was a case that Paul Soglin brought against the university, saying that many of the rules that they were enforcing were not, students were not aware of the rules, and that you can't enforce the rules, that students don't have copies of the rules. And the judge, James Doyle, the governor's, present governor's father, ruled in favor of Soglin. And at that time, the effect of that was that basically all of the day-to-day operating rules that the university had to deal with students and student organizations were suddenly tossed out the window. And I can remember during that period, in terms of student organizations, Peter Bunn, who was the student organization advisor at the time, he and I got together to work out a process so that we could have some form of set some standards of what student organizations needed to do to register and be recognized as a student organization so that they could use university space. Mm-hmm. And it was the group had to have some kind of a charter or a constitution or a statement of procedures. Mm-hmm. Needed to have at least 3 officers, each of whom were students, and it had to have at least 5 members. And if you met those criteria, we would recognize you as a student organization, and then we would let you. Then you could reserve meeting rooms on campus. Mm-hmm. But we needed to have something to just operate to service the student organization. Some of whom were protest groups. The majority of whom were just ordinary student organizations that were trying to carry out their function. Mm-hmm. But we had to have something to be able to handle these students so that they could continue to carry out their kinds of functions that were happening on a regular, ongoing basis. But that's the kind of mood we were in. We were just scrambling to try to keep one step ahead and meet the next emergency that was going to come up.
Ted, were you here quite a bit? Did you ever stay in your office overnight?
No, I never did overnight. We had building maintenance men. We had a building maintenance staff that was in the building all night long. So we had staff members in the building. Mm-hmm. I never stayed overnight. I did spend a lot of time here during the day and nighttime. But at some point in the evening, I always managed to go home. Mm-hmm. I was comfortable in doing that because I knew we had staff members. Those days we would lock the building typically at 11 o'clock on weeknights and 12:30 or 1 o'clock on weekends. Mm-hmm. And then the maintenance staff would come in and clean up the major food units and the corridors. And that by that time, people would have dispersed. There was no great pressure to stay open later. Mm-hmm. People would have dispersed to go other places, back to their own apartments or wherever. And so we never had any great pressure that I can recall, to keep the building open later. That wasn't an issue. The protest activities were over with by then, and the people would disperse and go their ways. And they knew that the building was going to close, and it just was never... That never was an issue. It became an issue later on in terms of keeping it later open later for study hall for exam periods and so on. But that wasn't an issue around the protest year periods.
Ted, were you in pretty close communication with the chancellor's office during those years of protest?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did they want to hear from you regularly? What was happening down here?
That's right. We were in close communication with representatives of the chancellor's office, Ralph Hansen, who was the head of police police force, mm-hmm. Campus security force at those days, protection and security, that was the name. Ralph Hansen, who was in regular communications with the chancellor, with Art Hovey, who was a special aide to the chancellor, mm-hmm. and with several others, and we would just touch base almost daily in terms of what was happening and what did they hear as plans that were anticipated for the evening or for the daytime, and mm-hmm. so we had a pretty good idea of what was going to happen, and there was, to a certain extent, there was we didn't put ourselves in a role of trying to overhear what the plans were mm-hmm. for the protest years, because we didn't see that as our role. We knew that there were people, as I mentioned earlier, that there were people on the police force that were there who were undercover agents and that were present as part of the whole protest period.
How would you become aware of what the students were planning?
People talk. Uh-huh. Students that were involved with the union, other students would make comments about it. Well, here's what you can anticipate today. And, you know, we would ask, well, what's up for today? And, well, da-da-da-da-da. Mm-hmm. Here's the plans. And then if there was something particular in the area, we would get it from the University Protection Security, would mention it also mm-hmm. on occasion. But we had a, you know, we didn't know the specifics, but there was a pretty general knowledge of what the plan was. And while we weren't involved in was, we weren't involved in anything that concerned how the campus police force and the city police department were going to respond in any given situation out on campus. Mm-hmm. We would see it as it unfolded, just as everybody else would see it. And we'd see it in terms of people coming back to the union. Mm-hmm. But we didn't know what the plan was, specifically.
Now, Ted, for yourself, were you highly visible in the union at that time? Were you out in the halls a lot, or were you more at Command Central, so
no,
to speak?
No, I was around and about a lot, and we didn't have, you know, I think back of we didn't have any so-called Command Central.
Well, I guess I was thinking, where were you in your office?
Yeah, I was out and about a lot. Mm-hmm. I would stop by regularly and listen in on some of the meetings that just to observe the size of the group and uh-huh. when they started and when they stopped, and depending on what I did happen to hear, and in a given occasion, I might pass that on to protection security, depending on if I made a judgment that, yeah, that's information that would be of value in knowing what's happening. There were a lot of officers around that knew what was going on and were part of this.
Now, this what were the summers like here? I'm thinking of the you came in July 1, mm-hmm. of 68. The summer of 69 and the summer of 70. What were those like?
I don't recall of any significant protests during that period.
So
during the summer period,
it would be like a regular summer.
Yeah, except that the atmosphere was certainly different. I mean, the summer of 70, having just coming off of a period where the university shut its classrooms down, mm-hmm. obviously it's going to be different than a normal summer session. But we didn't have protests in the summer the way we did during the regular school year.
Was summer school offered the summer of 70?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was trying to, as you were asking that question, I was trying to think back, and I don't even remember any particular protest on campus as a reaction to the outburst in Chicago at the time of the Democratic mm-hmm. Convention in 1968. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember that any particular activity at that point that was protest related. Mm-hmm. I can remember thinking how awful it was mm-hmm. to see what I was seeing on television, but I don't remember any protests connected with that.
Mm-hmm. I was just, so in a sense, hoofers were still
oh, yeah.
active
yeah.
in the
yeah.
summertime. And
absolutely.
Beer on the terrace and
yeah.
movies. And
yeah, absolutely.
So that continued.
That continued. Mm-hmm. We tried, in terms of programming, and we tried to take the approach that we were going to continue to offer what we always offered, And for those students that wanted that kind of activity, that would be there for them. Mm-hmm. And so whether it was Hoofers or whether it was movies or lectures or whatever, there would be a knowledge that we were running those activities, and those people who were interested in those activities could continue to participate in them. Mm-hmm. That, we felt that was very important.
Ted, who were some of the key students that you were working with in those days?
Well, I'm chuckling because it reminds me of an amazing story. One of the leaders at the time of the SDS, the Students for Democratic Society, one of the leaders in the campus SDS group was a fellow by the name of Billy Kaplan. And he was, I didn't have any contact with him at the time. But we certainly knew who Billy Kaplan was and as head of SDS, and he was one of the major or significant campus leaders on the campus, because SDS at that time had a very strong role on the campus. Flash forward 50 years, and I'm at a dinner up in the Edgewater Hotel, the university had set up a special memorial for Bob Kastenmeyer, who used to be a representative from this area. There was a lecture fund set up in Bob's name, and each year at the time of the lecture, the committee, Kastenmeyer Lecture Committee, would meet for dinner up in the Edgewater following the Kastenmeyer lecture. And I'm up at this dinner with my wife, and I'm sitting next to a person. We started talking, and all of a sudden I realized I was sitting next to Billy Kaplan. And I said, "Wait a minute, are you the, are you the," one of those kinds of exchanges. And we had a fascinating conversation that night. And subsequently, we were in Washington a couple of years ago and called Bill up, and we went out for dinner at that time with Bob Kastenmeyer in Washington. And just had a delightful evening. But and one of the comments that Bill made, what was it like with your family? And he said, it was a really interesting situation, because my brother was in the military and he was very, very much opposed to any anti-war activity. And we were just at opposite ends of the spectrum in this regard. And I said, "Have you ever reconciled with your brother?" And he said, "Not really. That's still, it's one of those things that we were just so far apart." At the time, my contact with people who were involved in the protest activities was more in terms of as we would deal with them for building use questions, or they caused some problems in the building in one way or another, and we would come in contact with them from that standpoint, the protest leaders, there was a small handful of them who were really the leadership group. Mm-hmm. Campus police, of course, were quite different, because they had a lot of contact with specific individuals. But I didn't have that much contact with them, other than, again, and from a building use standpoint or seeing them around regularly or just knowing them from being students. So, in terms of the union leadership, they were very definitely involved in observers and what was going on, and as I mentioned earlier, they at that one point when I thought about closing the building, they were right there to give a counter view on why it was important not to close the building, mm-hmm. in terms of students at the time, that this was such an important safety valve for the students on campus, and that we should not close the building.
Ted, you were one of the key administrators at that time, being in charge of the union, and I know Art Hovey was up there, and there was a whole range of talented people who loved the university and had been here for a long time, who probably had never, and I'm asking you, anticipated that they would be seeing this kind of experience. Or activity at the university.
Absolutely. absolutely no idea. Art Hovey, Paul Ginsberg, Roger Howard, Joe Corey, Peter Bunn, who I mentioned earlier. We used to get together on a every other week basis, or even a weekly basis, in Paul Ginsberg's office, just to talk about how things were going, just to touch base, mm-hmm. And see what Joel Skornick was another one that was involved in that for a while, just to see what was going on and to touch base, make sure we knew what the others were involved with and what they were doing and what kinds of pressures they were feeling. But and this was, it wasn't the top leadership in terms of mm-hmm. the chancellor and the vice chancellor. Mm-hmm. This was a group of people who were involved in the day-to-day mm-hmm. activities of what was happening on campus. And the amazing thing was that within that level of building managers and university officials, there was all kinds of communication on almost a daily basis of what was going on. Mm-hmm. We didn't have email at the time.
Right.
Everything was telephone or in person. Mm-hmm. But we sure kept in close contact with each other about what was going on.
And this is sort of re-asking what I asked you earlier. Was the general feeling among those of you who ran the university that this student activity was inevitable given the national climate, or was there anger that this was happening to your beloved university, or was there resignation and sort of what you said that you knew that this would pass?
Well, there was a lot of anger, and at a personal level about what people were doing and what it was at the cost,
uh-huh.
In terms of university prestige, in terms of university budget implications, in terms of image.
Mm-hmm.
I think knowing what we did about what was going on nationally and internationally as far as the country was concerned and its battle in Vietnam, there was a resignation that it's not surprising that this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back, you have to take this whole thing in the context of what happened earlier in the 60s in terms of the protest on segregation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really where it got its start.
Mm-hmm.
And students found that they could have a voice and that there was a lot of agreement among students in terms of the issues and a willingness to get in and try to change the issue of segregation, and they found success.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing just transferred with a different group of people in many cases, but the process, the procedures, the techniques just transferred to from the segregation, efforts to change segregation onto the moving to try and get the United States out of the war in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And they saw results because people started questioning. Students were ready to be concerned, and this relates to the fact that students were subject to the draft at that point,
mm-hmm.
and that made a big difference. And you contrast that setting of late 60s and early 70s with what's happened in the last decade in Iraq, when there was no draft, and it never came home to students, and as a result, even though there were numerous tries to try to organize students to protest the Iraq War, none of them ever took hold,
mm-hmm.
because it was just a different climate. It wasn't affecting students,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't affecting their continuing role as a student. But back in Vietnam, it did,
mm-hmm.
and you were facing with the questions of, well, do I get drafted, or do I go up to Canada to escape the draft, or how am I going to deal with this? And these were very personal issues, and students just across the board were heavily invested in this issue in this Vietnam War, in mm-hmm. great contrast to where we've been in the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, a couple other things that I think were so different. The university didn't know how to deal with these kinds of protests initially. Mm-hmm. The Madison police didn't know how to deal with them. And they dealt with them in a way that just provided fodder to those who were protesting. Mm-hmm. And that instead of, you know, I'm sure you've heard the stories of how Ralph Hansen used to, when they were picketing around Bascom Hall, and the university had a rule against picketing and blocking access to classes. And Ralph would go, he was the head of protection security, and he would go and stand in the line and talk to the pickets, and the people would start to talk to him, and that would open an avenue for students to get through to classes. So they weren't breaking the university rule on blocking access to a building and those kinds of techniques. So those were being learned at the time and came in. As this went on, it became more and more handy to do things in that way. Plus, there was also a change, and it came later in the 70s with the direction of the Madison Police Department, where some of the hardline officers retired or were replaced. The police chief changed, and again, the Madison Police Department learned a lot from this experience. And so, mm-hmm. how they would have handled a situation today or a decade ago would have been quite different from what it was back in Vietnam when we were learning this for the first time. And so much of the student response was one of just seeing the over-response of officials, which only encouraged more student participation, mm-hmm. or more student anger, mm-hmm. To see how this, in the student mind, they were just... it was just an unnecessary use of force, and that only drew out more to join the protest ranks.
Ted, what was it like working with the student directors of the union in those days? Is that the directorate?
Yeah, the directorate. Well, We spent a lot of time talking about what was going on campus, what the effect would be in terms of programming, mm-hmm. and what would be appropriate responses. Mm-hmm. Should we change our way of doing things? Mm-hmm. So that there was a lot of discussion about what was happening and how to respond, mm-hmm. and out of those, the decision to try in terms of programming to continue on in a normal pattern insofar as possible. And depending on the time of year and depending on the where you were located, I mean, for the most part, Union South, for example, which was open during, that's opened in 71, but, you know, that was a different world over on the engineering side of the campus from what was happening here on the humanities side, mm-hmm. around Bascom Hall and State Street and the mall and the Union. And depending on the time of day and the time of year, there wouldn't be anything going on. Mm-hmm. But outside events were driving this constantly, because mm-hmm. when things would happen in Vietnam or the United States would respond in a certain way, that would provide impetus, a spark, to generate new rounds of protests. And the protesters knew what it was that would push the button for the police department. And so that's the first thing they would head towards, mm-hmm. and it was just a constant struggle to try and gain support. But the audiences they were playing to were two totally different audiences. The students were playing the students' audiences and trying to get people to build their anger towards Vietnam. And in many respects, they were successful, mm-hmm. because they forced Johnson's eventually. That was a major part of the resignation of Johnson as president, mm-hmm. not running in 1968. And it was that constant pressure that continued when Nixon was president in the early 70s that led eventually to a settlement of the Vietnam conflict.
Ted, did you have any contact with state legislators yourself during this time period?
The only time that I had contact with state legislators was on the issue of drug abuse, drugs in the union. Mm-hmm. Where I had to appear both at a regent meeting and at a legislative meeting, and also was contacted by some legislators about drug use. But drug use was such a scare word for people, mm-hmm. and the overreaction was just really amazing, the way we reacted to the issue of marijuana, or in particular, because there was so much of it around, and it was they just felt if we could solve the marijuana problem, we wouldn't have any of the other problems. Mm-hmm. I think it was almost that kind of an attitude.
Mm-hmm. And what kinds of things were they asking you?
Why is there so much drug activity in the union? Why aren't you doing something about it? Why aren't you shutting off the supply? Why aren't you arresting these people? What are you doing about it? Mm-hmm. What are you going to do about it? Why are you letting those people who are smoking in the building? Mm-hmm. Why don't you kick them out of the campus? Get rid of them. Easier said than done.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have one mm-hmm. more question for you. So, Ted, the Sterling Hall bombing happens, and you said it was like a curtain mm-hmm. came down. So what is that first year like from 70-71 with the restoration of a certain kind of calm?
Shell shock?
Uh-huh.
People stopped attending programs. People stopped doing anything other than going to the library or to the classes, or going to the library because that's where the books were that they needed for their classroom work. But it just absolutely drained all emotion out of people. Mm-hmm. And everything just shut down. And student organizations stopped functioning. Student participation stopped across the board. And it took, 3 or 4 years before, it was the mid-70s, before things started to swing around again. And you could just feel an excitement in the air at the start of this new school year of student organizations getting reactivated and students being excited about moving back towards the campus again and getting involved and being around campus. I mean, it was just a very dramatic shutdown with that Sterling Hall bombing. People were afraid. They were frightened. They were scared. They were shocked. And
so the union had a quiet year.
In terms of activity, yes, very quiet, very quiet. It was a totally different atmosphere on campus. Once that bomb went off, it just dramatically changed everything. And it affected all aspects of the campus. I mean, you could go back and look at building use charts for student organizations and meetings, and it just bottoms there and starts slowly building up again.
Mm-hmm.
Food units, same way. All activities, all programs. I mean, it just, the campus shut down. People moved away from the campus. They moved out into the community.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to be near the campus. They were fed up with the protests because they saw this as an end result and they didn't want to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was just great separation from the university. And it just, as I said, it took 2, 3, 4 years before that pendulum to swing around and student activity begin to regenerate itself.
And for yourself,
what that's saying is a whole new generation of students
mm-hmm.
before it started again.
And for yourself, that year after Sterling Hall, was there some relief that the tumult was over?
Well, my role and the staff's role changed because there wasn't the constant pressure in terms of building use, and there wasn't the constant pressure of what next, and of knowing what was happening. So all of a sudden, yes, we had time that we hadn't previously had.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we also were drained. And mm-hmm. we were drained, staff was drained emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
And we were trying to put things back together again and to restructure our way of doing things. And I had talked about how we had to get student organizations organized once again, and so there was a lot of rebuilding in a lot of different ways that was happening, that was all part of this renewal that was slowly going to begin. But it took 2 to 3 years before that really caught hold and began to happen. Put it in the closet in here.
This now concludes the February 16th session with Ted Crabb.